to plunder and harass the old and the children and womenfolk of Hador's people. The remnant of the Eldar of Hithlum, all those who did not escape into the wilds and the mountains, he took to the mines of Angband, and they became his thralls. But the orcs went freely through all the north, and pressed ever southward into Beleriand. There Doriath yet remained, and Nargothrond. But Morgoth gave little heed to them, either because he knew little of them, or because their hour was not yet come in the designs of his malice. But his thought ever returned to Turgon. Therefore Húrin was brought before Morgoth, for Morgoth knew by his arts and his spies that Húrin had the friendship of the king. And he sought to daunt him with his eyes. But Húrin could not yet be daunted, and he defied Morgoth. Therefore Morgoth had him chained and set in slow torment. But after a while he came to him and offered him his choice, to go free whither he would, or to receive power and rank as the greatest of Morgoth's captains, if he would but reveal where Turgon had his stronghold, and aught else that he knew of the king's counsels. But Húrin the steadfast mocked him, saying, "Blind you are, Morgoth Bauglir, and blind shall ever be, seeing only the dark. You know not what rules the hearts of men, and if you knew, you could not give it. But a fool is he who accepts what Morgoth offers. You will take first the price, and then withhold the promise, and I should get only death if I told you what you ask." Then Morgoth laughed, and he said, "Death you may yet crave of me, as a boon." Then he took Húrin to the Howden Nirnaeth, and it was then new built, and the reek of death was upon it. And Morgoth set Húrin upon its top, and bade him look west towards Hithlum, and think of his wife and his son and other kin. "For they dwell now in my realm," said Morgoth, "and they are at my mercy." "You have none," answered Húrin, "but you will not come at Turgon through them, for they do not know his secrets." Then wrath mastered Morgoth, and he said, "Yet I may come at you and all your accursed house, and you shall be broken on my will, though you all were made of steel." And he took up a long sword that lay there, and broke it before the eyes of Húrin, and a splinter wounded his face. But Húrin did not blench. Then Morgoth, stretching out his long arm towards Dol-Lomin, cursed Húrin and Morwen and their offspring, saying, "Behold, the shadow of my thought shall lie upon them wherever they go, and my hate shall pursue them to the ends of the world." But Húrin said, "You speak in vain, for you cannot see them, nor govern them from afar, not while you keep this shape, and desire still to be a king visible on earth." Then Morgoth turned upon Húrin, and he said, "Fool, little among men, and they are the least of all that speak. Have you seen the Valar, or measured the power of Manwë and Vardar? Do you know the reach of their thought, or do you think perhaps that their thought is upon you, and that they may shield you from afar?"
"I know not," said Húrin, "yet so it might be if they willed, for the elder king shall not be dethroned while Arda endures."
"You say it," said Morgoth. "I am the elder king, Melkor, first and mightiest of all the Valar,
who was before the world and made it. The shadow of my purpose lies upon Arda, and all that is in it bends slowly and surely to my will. Upon all whom you love, my thought shall weigh as a cloud of doom, and it shall bring them down into darkness and despair. Wherever they go, evil shall arise. Whenever they speak, their words shall bring ill counsel. Whatsoever they do shall turn against them. They shall die without hope, cursing both life and death.
But Húrin answered, "Do you forget to whom you speak? Such things you spoke long ago to our fathers, but we escaped from your shadow. And now we have knowledge of you, for we have looked on the faces that have seen the light, and heard the voices that have spoken with Manwë. Before Arda you were, but others also, and you did not make it. Neither are you the most mighty, for you have spent your strength upon yourself, and wasted it in your own emptiness. No more are you now than an escaped thrall of the Valar, and their chain still awaits you. You have learned the lessons of your masters by rote," said Morgoth, "but such childish lore will not help you now they are all fled away. This last, then, I will say to you, thrall Morgoth," said Húrin, "and it comes not from the law of the Eldar, but is put into my heart in this hour. You are not the lord of men, and shall not be, though all Arda and Menel fall in your dominion. Beyond the circles of the world you shall not pursue those who refuse you. Beyond the circles of the world I will not pursue them," said Morgoth, "for beyond the circles of the world there is nothing, but within them they shall not escape me until they enter into nothing."
"You lie," said Húrin.
"You shall see, and you shall confess that I do not lie," said Morgoth.
And taking Húrin back to Angband, he set him in a chair of stone upon a high place of Thangorodrim, from which he could see afar the land of Hislum in the west and the lands of Beleriand in the south. There he was bound by the power of Morgoth, and Morgoth, standing beside him, cursed him again and set his power upon him, so that he could not move from that place nor die until Morgoth should release him.
"Sit now there," said Morgoth, "and look out upon the lands, where evil and despair shall come upon those whom you have delivered to me. For you have dared to mock me, and have questioned the power of Melkor, master of the fates of Arda. Therefore, with my eyes you shall see, and with my ears you shall hear, and nothing shall be hidden from you."
Chapter 4. The Departure of Túrin. To Brethil, three men only, found their way back at last through Tar Nufuin, an evil road. And when Glorethel, Hadal's daughter, learned of the fall of Haldir, she grieved and died. To Dor Lomin no tidings came. Rian, wife of Huor, fled into the wild, distraught. But she was aided by the grey elves of Mithrim, and when her child, Tuor, was born, they fostered him. But Rian went to the Houth en Nirnaeth and laid herself down there and died. Morwen Elethwen remained in Hithlum, silent in grief. Her son, Turin, was only in his 9th year, and she was again with child. Her days were evil. The Easterlings came into the land in great numbers, and they dealt cruelly with the people of Hador, and robbed them of all that they possessed, and enslaved them. All the people of Húrin's homelands that could work or serve any purpose, they took away, even young girls and boys, and the old they killed or drove out to starve. But they dared not yet lay hands on the lady of Dor Lomin, or thrust her from her house, for the word ran among them that she was perilous, and a witch who had dealings with the white fiends, for so they named the elves, hating them, but fearing them more. For this reason they also feared and avoided the mountains, in which many of the Eldar had taken refuge, especially in the south of the land. And after plundering and harrying, the Easterlings drew back northwards. For Húrin's house stood in the southeast of Dor Lomin, and the mountains were near. Nen Lalaith, indeed, came down from a spring under the shadow of Amon Darthir, over whose shoulder there was a steep pass. By this the Hardy could cross Ered Wethrin and come down by the wells of Glithui into Beleriand. But this was not known to the Easterlings, nor to Morgoth yet. For all that country, while the house of Fingolfin stood, was secure from him, and none of his servants had ever come there. He trusted that Ered Wethrin was a wall insurmountable, both against escape from the north and against assault from the south, and there was indeed no other pass for the unwinged between Serech and far westward, where Dor Lomin marched with Nevrast. Thus it came to pass that after the first inroads, Morwen was let be, though there were men that lurked in the woods about, and it was perilous to stir far abroad. There still remained, under Morwen's shelter, Sador the woodwright, and a few old men and women, and Turin, whom she kept close within the garth. But the homestead of Húrin soon fell into decay, and though Morwen laboured hard, she was poor, and would have gone hungry but for the help that was sent to her secretly by Eirin, Húrin's kinswoman. For a certain Broda, one of the Easterlings, had taken her by force to be his wife. Alms were bitter to Morwen, but she took this aid for the sake of Turin and her unborn child, and because, as she said, it came of her own. For it was this brother who had seized the people, the goods, and the cattle of Húrin's homelands, and carried them off to his own dwellings. He was a bold man, but of small account among his own people, before they came to Hithlum. And so, seeking wealth, he was ready to hold lands that others of his sort did not covet. Morwen he had seen once, when he rode to her house on a foray, but a great dread of her had seized him. He thought that he had looked in the fell eyes of a white fiend, and he was filled with a mortal fear lest some evil should overtake him, and he did not ransack her house, nor discover Turin. Else the life of the heir of the true lord would have been short. Broda made thralls of the straw heads, as he named the people of Hador, and set them to build him a wooden hall in the land to the northward of Húrin's house. And within a stockade his slaves were herded like cattle in a byre, but ill-guarded. Among them, some could still be found uncowed and ready to help the Lady of Dorlomin, even at their peril, and from them came secretly tidings of the land to Morwen, though there was little hope in the news they brought. But Brodda took Eirin as a wife and not a slave, for there were few women amongst his own following, and none to compare with the daughters of the Edain, and he hoped to make himself a lordship in that country, and have an heir to hold it after him. Of what had happened, and of what might happen in the days to come, Morwen said little to Turin, and he feared to break her silence with questions. When the Easterlings first came into Dorlomin, he said to his mother, "When will my father come back to cast out these ugly thieves? Why does he not come?" Morwen answered, "I do not know. It may be that he was slain, or that he is held captive, or again it may be that he was driven far away and cannot yet return through the foes that surround us." "Then I think that he is dead," said Turin, and before his mother he restrained his tears, for no one could keep him from coming back to help us if he were alive. "I do not think that either of those things are true, my son," said Morwen. As the time lengthened, the heart of Morwen grew darker for her son Turin, heir of Dorlomin and Ladros, for she could see no hope for him better than to become a slave of the Easterling men before he was much older. Therefore she remembered her words with Húrin, and her thought turned again to Doriath, and she resolved at last to send Turin away in secret if she could, and to beg King Thingol to harbour him. And as she sat and pondered how this might be done, she heard clearly in her thought the voice of Húrin saying to her, "Go swiftly, do not wait for me." But the birth of her child was drawing near, and the road would be hard and perilous. The more that went, the less hope of escape. And her heart still cheated her with hope unadmitted. Her inmost thought foreboded that Húrin was not dead, and she listened for his footfall in the sleepless watches of the night, or would wake, thinking that she had heard in the courtyard the neigh of Aroch his horse. Moreover, though she was willing that her son should be fostered in the halls of another, after the manner of that time, she would not yet humble her pride to be an alms guest, not even of a king. Therefore the voice of Húrin, or the memory of his voice, was denied, and the first strand of the fate of Turin was woven. Autumn of the year of lamentation was drawing on, before Morwen came to this resolve, and then she was in haste, for the time of journeying was short, but she dreaded that Turin would be taken if she waited over winter. Easterlings were prowling round the garth, and spying on the house. Therefore she said suddenly to Turin, "Your father does not come, so you must go, and soon. It is as he would wish."
"Go?" cried Turin. "Whither shall we go? Over the mountains?"
"Yes," said Morwen, "over the mountains, away south. South, that way some hope may lie. But I did not say we, my son. You must go, but I must stay."
"I cannot go alone," said Turin. "I will not leave you. Why should we not go together?"
"I cannot go," said Morwen, "but you will not go alone. I shall send Gethron with you, and Grithnir too, perhaps."
"Will you not send Labadal?"
said Turin. "No, for Sator is lame," said Morwen, "and it will be a hard road. And since you are my son, and the days are grim, I will not speak softly. You may die on that road. The year is getting late, but if you stay, you will come to a worse end, to be a thrall. If you wish to be a man, when you come to a man's age, you will do as I bid, bravely."
"'But I shall leave you only with Sador and blind Ragnir and the old women,' said Turin. "'Did not my father say that I am the heir of Hador? "'The heir should stay in Hador's house to defend it. "'How I wish that I still had my knife!'
"'The heir should stay, but he cannot,' said Morwen. "'But he may return one day. "'Now take heart. I will follow you if things grow worse, if I can.'
"'But how will you find me, lost in the wild?'
said Turin, and suddenly his heart failed him, and he wept openly. "'If you wail, other things will find you first,' said Morwen. "'But I know whither you are going, and if you come there, and if you remain there, there I will find you, if I can. For I am sending you to King Thingol in Doriath. Would you not rather be a king's guest than a thrall?
"'I do not know,' said Turin. "'I do not know what a thrall is.'
"'I am sending you away, sir, but you need not learn it,' Morwen answered.
Then she set Turin before her and looked into his eyes, as if she were trying to read some riddle there.
"'It is hard, Turin, my son,' she said at length. Not hard for you only. It is heavy on me in evil days to judge what is best to do. But I do as I think right. For why else should I part with the thing most dear that is left to me?
They spoke no more of this together, and Turin was grieved and bewildered. In the morning he went to find Sador, who had been hewing sticks for firing, of which they had little. But they dared not stray out in the woods, and now he leant on his crutch and looked at the great chair of Húrin, which had been thrust unfinished in a corner. "'It must go,' he said, "'for only bare needs can be served in these days.'
"'Do not break it yet,' said Turin. "'Maybe he will come home, and then it will please him to see what you have done for him while he was away.'
"'False hopes are more dangerous than fears,' said Sador, "'and they will not keep us warm this winter.'
"'He fingered the carving on the chair and sighed.
"'I wasted my time,' he said, "'though the hours seemed pleasant. "'But all such things are short-lived, "'and the joy in the making is their only true end, I guess. "'And now I might as well give you back your gift.'
Turin put out his hand and quickly withdrew it.
"'A man does not take back his gifts,' he said.
"'But if it is my own, may I not give it as I will?' said Sador.
"'Yes,'
said Turin,
"'to any man but me. "'But why should you wish to give it?'
"'I have no hope of using it for worthy tasks,' Sador said. There will be no work for Labadal in days to come, but thrall work.
"'What is a thrall?' said Turin.
"'A man who was a man, but is treated as a beast,' Sador answered. "'Fed only to keep alive, kept alive only to toil, toiling only for fear of pain or death. And from these robbers he may get pain or death, just for their sport.' I hear that they pick some of the fleet-footed and hunt them with hounds. They have learned quicker from the orcs than we learnt from the fair folk.
Now I understand things better, said Turin.
It is a shame that you should have to understand such things so soon, said Sador. Then seeing the strange look on Turin's face, what do you understand now?
"'Why, my mother is sending me away,'
said Turin, and tears filled his eyes. "'Ah,' said Sador, and he muttered to himself, "'but why so long delayed?'
Then turning to Turin, he said, "'That does not seem news for tears to me. "'But you should not speak your mother's counsels aloud to Labadal or to anyone. "'All walls and fences have ears these days.' Ears that do not grow on fair heads.
"'But I must speak with someone,' said Turin.
I've always told things to you. I do not want to leave you, Labadal. I do not want to leave this house or my mother.
But if you do not, said Sador, soon there will be an end of the house of Hador forever, as you must understand now. Labadal does not want you to go, but Sador, servant of Húrin, will be happier when Húrin's son is out of the reach of the Easterlings.
Well, well, it cannot be helped. We must say farewell.
Now will you not take my knife as a parting gift?
No, said Túrin. I am going to the elves, to the king of Doriath, my mother says. There I may get other things like it. But I shall not be able to send you any gifts, Labadal. I shall be far away and all alone.
Then Túrin wept. But Sador said to him,
Hey, now, where is Húrin's son? For I heard him say not long ago, I shall go as a soldier with an elf king as soon as I am able.
Then Túrin stayed his tears, and he said, Very well, if those were the words of the son of Húrin, he must keep them and go. But whenever I say that I will do this or that, it looks very different when the time comes. Now I am unwilling. I must take care not to say such things again.
It would be best indeed, said Sador. So most men teach, and few men learn. Let the unseen days be. Today is more than enough.
Now Túrin was made ready for the journey, and he bade farewell to his mother, and departed in secret with his two companions. But when they bade Túrin turn and look back upon the house of his father, then the anguish of parting smote him like a sword, and he cried,
Morwen, Morwen, when shall I see you again?
But Morwen, standing on her threshold, heard the echo of that cry in the wooded hills, and she clutched the post of the door so that her fingers were torn. This was the first of the sorrows of Túrin. Early in the year after Túrin was gone, Morwen gave birth to her child, and she named her Nienor, which is mourning. But Túrin was already far away when she was born. Long and evil was his road, for the power of Morgoth was ranging far abroad. But he had as guides Gethron and Grithnir, who had been young in the days of Hador, and though they were now aged, they were valiant, and they knew well the lands, for they had journeyed often through Beleriand in former times. Thus, by fate and courage, they passed over the shadowy mountains, and coming down into the vale of Sirion they passed into the forest of Brethil, and at last, weary and haggard, they reached the confines of Doriath. But there they became bewildered, and were enmeshed in the mazes of the queen, and wandered lost amid the pathless trees until all their food was spent. There they came near to death, for winter came cold from the north. But not so light was Túrin's tomb. Even as they lay in despair, they heard a horn sounded. Beleg the Strongbow was hunting in that region, for he dwelt ever on the marches of Doriath, and he was the greatest woodsman of those days. He heard their cries, and came to them, and when he had given them food and drink, he learned their names, and whence they came, and he was filled with wonder and pity. And he looked with liking upon Túrin, for he had the beauty of his mother, and the eyes of his father, and he was sturdy and strong. What boon would you have of King Thingol? Said Beleg to the boy.
I would be one of his knights, to ride against Morgoth and avenge my father, said Túrin.
That may well be when the years have increased you, said Beleg, for though you are yet small, you have the makings of a valiant man, worthy to be a son of Húrin the Steadfast, if that were possible. For the name of Húrin was held in honour in all the lands of the elves.
Therefore Beleg gladly became the guide of the wanderers, and he led them to a lodge where he dwelt at that time with other hunters, and there they were housed while a messenger went to Menegroth. And when word came back that Thingol and Melian would receive the son of Húrin and his guardians, Beleg led them by secret ways into the hidden kingdom. Thus Túrin came to the great bridge over the Escalduin, and passed the gates of Thingol's halls, and as a child he gazed upon the marvels of Menegroth, which no mortal man before had seen, save Beren only. Then Gethron spoke the message of Morwen before Thingol and Melian, and Thingol received them kindly, and set Túrin upon his knee, in honour of Húrin, mightiest of men, and of Beren his kinsman. And those that saw this marvel, for it was a sign that Thingol took Túrin as his foster son, and that was not at that time done by kings, nor ever again by elf lord to a man. Then Thingol said to him, "Here, son of Húrin, shall your home be, and in all your life you shall be held as my son, man though you be. Wisdom shall be given you beyond the measure of mortal men, and the weapons of the elves shall be set in your hands. Perhaps the time may come when you shall regain the lands of your father in Hithlum, but dwell now here in love." Thus began the sojourn of Túrin in Doriath. With him remained for a while Gethron and Grithnir, his guardians, though they yearned to return again to their lady in Dor Lomin. Then age and sickness came upon Grithnir, and he stayed beside Túrin until he died. But Gethron departed, and Thingol sent with him an escort to guide him and guard him. And they brought words from Thingol to Morwen. They came at last to Húrin's house, and when Morwen learned that Túrin was received with honour in the halls of Thingol, her grief was lightened. And the elves brought also rich gifts from Melian, and a message bidding her return with Thingol's folk to Doriath. For Melian was wise and foresighted, and she hoped thus to avert the evil that was prepared in the thought of Morgoth. But Morwen would not depart from her house, for her heart was yet unchanged, and her pride still high. Moreover, Nienor was a babe in arms. Therefore she dismissed the elves of Doriath with her thanks, and gave them in gift the last small things of gold that remained to her, concealing her poverty. And she bade them take back to Thingol the helm of Hador. But Túrin watched ever for the return of Thingol's messengers, and when they came back alone he fled into the woods and wept. For he knew of Melian's bidding, and he had hoped that Morwen would come. This was the second sorrow of Túrin. When the messengers spoke Morwen's answer, Melian was moved with pity, perceiving her mind, and she saw that the fate which she foreboded could not lightly be set aside. The helm of Hador was given into Thingol's hands. That helm was made of grey steel, adorned with gold, and on it were graven runes of victory. A power was in it that guarded any who wore it from wound or death, for the sword that hewed it was broken, and the dart that smote it sprang aside. It was wrought by Telkar, the smith of Nogrod, whose works were renowned. It had a visor, after the manner of those that the dwarves used in their forges for the shielding of their eyes, and the face of one that wore it struck fear into the hearts of all beholders, but was itself guarded from dart and fire. Upon its crest was set in defiance a gilded image of Glaurung the dragon, for it had been made soon after he first issued from the gates of Morgoth. Often Hador and Galdor after him had borne it in war, and the hearts of the host of Hithlum were uplifted when they saw it towering high amid the battle And they cried, "Of more worth is the dragon of Dodlomin than the gold worm of Angband." But Húrin did not wear the dragon helm with ease, and in any case he would not use it, for he said, "I would rather look on my foes with my true face." Nonetheless, he accounted the helm among the greatest heirlooms of his house. Now Thingol had in Menegroth deep armouries, filled with great wealth of weapons, metal wrought like fish's mail, and shining like water in the moon, swords and axes, shields and helms, wrought by Telkar himself, or by his master Gamil Zirak the Old, or by elven rites more skilful still. For some things he had received in gift that came out of Valinor, and were wrought by Feanor in his mastery, than whom no craftsman was greater in all the days of the world. Yet Thingol handled the helm of Hador as though his hoard were scanty, and he spoke courteous words, saying, "Proud were the head that bore this helm, which the sires of Húrin bore." Then a thought came to him, and he summoned Túrin, and told him that Morwen had sent to her son a mighty thing, the heirloom of his fathers. "Take now the dragon head of the north," he said, "and when the time comes, wear it well." But Túrin was yet too young to lift the helm, and he heeded it not, because of the sorrow of his heart. Chapter 5. Túrin in Doriath. In the years of his childhood in the kingdom of Doriath, Túrin was watched over by Melian, though he saw her seldom. But there was a maiden named Nellas, who lived in the woods, and at Melian's bidding she would follow Túrin if he strayed in the forest, and often she met him there, as it were by chance. Then they played together, or walked hand in hand, for he grew swiftly, whereas she seemed no more than a maiden of his own age, and was so in heart for all her elven years. From Nellas Túrin learned much concerning the ways and the wild things of Doriath, and she taught him to speak the Sindarin tongue after the manner of the ancient realm, older and more courteous, and richer in beautiful words. Thus for a little while his mood was lightened, until he fell again under shadow, and that friendship passed like a morning of spring. For Nellas did not go to Menegroth, and was unwilling ever to walk under roofs of stone, so that as Túrin's boyhood passed, and he turned his thoughts to deeds of men, he saw her less and less often, and at last called for her no more. But she watched over him still, though now she remained hidden. 9 years Túrin dwelt in the halls of Menegroth, his heart and thought turned ever to his own kin, and at times he had tidings of them for his own comfort, for Thingol sent messengers to Morwen as often as he might, and she sent back words for her son. Thus Túrin heard that Morwen's plight was eased, and that his sister Nienor grew in beauty, a flower in the grey north. And Túrin grew in stature, until he became tall among men, and surpassed that of the elves of Doriath, and his strength and hardihood were renowned in the realm of Thingol. In those years he learned much lore, hearing eagerly the histories of ancient days and great deeds of old, and he became thoughtful and sparing in speech. Often Beleg's strong bow came to Menegroth to seek him, and led him far afield, teaching him woodcraft and archery, and, which he liked more, the handling of swords. But in crafts of making he had less skill, for he was slow to learn his own strength, and often marred what he made with some sudden stroke. In other matters also it seemed that fortune was unfriendly to him, so that often what he designed went awry, and what he desired he did not gain. Neither did he win friendship easily, for he was not merry, and laughed seldom, and a shadow lay on his youth. Nonetheless, he was held in love and esteem by those who knew him well, and he had honour as the fosterling of the king. Yet there was one in Doriath that begrudged him this, and ever the more as Turin drew nearer to manhood. Cyros was his name. He was proud, dealing haughtily with those whom he deemed of lesser state and worth than himself. He became a friend of Dairon the minstrel, for he also was skilled in song, and he had no love for men, and least of all for any kinsman of Beren One Hand. "This is not strange," said he, "that this land should be open to yet another of this unhappy race. Did not the other do harm enough in Doriath?" Therefore he looked askance at Turin, and on all that he did, saying what ill he could of it. But his words were cunning, and his malice failed. If he met with Turin alone, he spoke haughtily to him, and showed plain his contempt, and Turin grew weary of him, though for long he returned ill words with silence. For Cyros was great among the people of Doriath, and a counsellor of the king. But the silence of Turin displeased Cyros as much as his words. In the year that Turin was 17 years old, his grief was renewed, for all tidings from his home ceased at that time. The power of Morgoth had grown yearly, and all Hithlum was now under his shadow. Doubtless he knew much of the doings of Húrin's people and kin, and had not molested them for a while, so that his design might be fulfilled. But now, in pursuit of this purpose, he set a close watch on all the passes of the Shadowy Mountains, so that none might come out of Hithlum, nor enter it, save at great peril. And the orcs swarmed about the sources of Narog and Teiglin, and the upper waters of Sirion. Thus there came a time when the messengers of Thingol did not return, and he would send no more. He was ever loath to let any stray beyond the guarded borders, and in nothing had he shown greater goodwill to Húrin and his kin than in sending his people on the dangerous roads to Morwen in Dor Lomin. Now Turin grew heavy-hearted, not knowing what new evil was afoot, and fearing that an ill fate had befallen Morwen and Nienor, and for many days he sat silent, brooding on the downfall of the House of Hador and the men of the North. Then he rose up and went to seek Thingol, and he found him sitting with Melian under Hirilorn, the great beech of Menegroth. Thingol looked on Turin in wonder, seeing suddenly before him, in the place of his fosterling, a man, and a stranger, tall, dark-haired, looking at him with deep eyes and a white face, stern and proud. But he did not speak. "What do you desire, foster son?" said Thingol, and guessed that he would ask for nothing small. "Mail, sword, and shield of my stature, lord," answered Turin. "Also, by your leave, I will now reclaim the dragon helm of my sires." "These you shall have," said Thingol, "but what need have you yet of such arms?" "The need of a man," said Turin, "and of a son who has kin to remember. And I need also companions valiant in arms. I will appoint you a place among my knights of the sword, for the sword will ever be your weapon," said Thingol. "With them You may make trial of war upon the marches, if that is your desire. Beyond the marches of Doriath, my heart urges me, said Turin, for onset against our foe I long, rather than defence. Then you must go alone, said Thingol. The part of my people in the war with Angband I rule according to my wisdom, Turin, son of Hurin. No force of the arms of Doriath will I send out at this time, nor at any time that I can yet foresee. Yet you are free to go as you will, son of Morwen, said Melian. The girdle of Melian does not hinder the going of those that passed in with our leave. Unless wise counsel will restrain you, said Thingol. What is your counsel, lord? Said Turin. A man you seem in stature, and indeed more than many already, Thingol answered. But nonetheless you have not come to the fullness of your manhood that shall be. Until that is achieved you should be patient, testing and training your strength. Then maybe you can remember your kin. But there is little hope that one man alone can do more against the Dark Lord than to aid the Elf Lords in their defence, as long as that may last. Then Turin said, Beren, my kinsman, did more. Beren and Luthien, said Melian, but you are overbold to speak so to the father of Luthien. Not so high is your destiny, I think, Turin, son of Morwen, though greatness is in you, and your fate is twined with that of the elven folk, for good or for ill. Beware of yourself, lest it be ill. Then after a silence she spoke to him again, saying, Go now, foster son, and take the advice of the king, that will ever be wiser than your own counsel. Yet I do not think that you will long abide with us in Doriath beyond the coming of manhood. If in days to come you remember the words of Melian, it will be for your good. Fear both the heat and the cold of your heart, and strive for patience, if you can. Then Turin bowed before them, and took his leave. And soon after he put on the dragon helm, and took arms, and went away to the north marches, and was joined to the elven warriors who there waged unceasing war upon the orcs, and all the servants and creatures of Morgoth. Thus, while yet scarcely out of his boyhood, his strength and courage were proved, and remembering the wrongs of his kin, he was ever forward in deeds of daring, and he received many wounds by spear or arrow or the crooked blades of the orcs. But his doom delivered him from death, and word ran through the woods, and was heard far beyond Doriath, that the dragon helm of Dorlomin was seen again, and many wondered, saying, Can the spirit of any man return from death? Or has Hurin of Hithlum escaped, indeed, from the pits of hell? One only was mightier in arms among the march-wardens of Thingol at that time than Turin, and that was Beleg Strongbow. And Beleg and Turin were companions in every peril, and walked far and wide in the wild woods together. Thus 3 years passed, and in that time Turin came seldom to Thingol's halls, and he cared no longer for his looks or his attire, but his hair was unkempt, and his mail covered with a grey cloak stained with the weather. But it chanced, in the third summer after Turin's departure, when he was 20 years old, that desiring rest and needing smith work for the repair of his arms, he came unlooked for to Menegroth, and went one evening into the hall. Thingol was not there, for he was abroad in the greenwood with Melian, as was his delight at times in the high summer. Turin took a seat without heed, for he was way-worn and filled with thought, and by ill luck he set himself at a board among the elders of the realm, and in that place where Cyrus was accustomed to sit. Cyrus, entering late, was angered, believing that Turin had done this in pride and with intent to affront him, and his anger was not lessened to find that Turin was not rebuked by those that sat there, but was welcomed as one worthy to sit among them. For a while, therefore, Cyrus feigned to be of like mind, and took another seat, facing Turin across the board. "Seldom does the March Warden favour us with his company," he said, "and I gladly yield my accustomed seat for the chance of speech with him." But Turin, who was in converse with Mablung the hunter, did not rise, and said only a curt, "I thank you." Cyrus then plied him with questions concerning the news from the borders and his deeds in the wild, but though his words seemed fair, the mockery in his voice could not be mistaken. Then Turin became weary, and he looked about him and knew the bitterness of exile, and for all the light and laughter of the elven halls, his thought turned to Beleg and their life in the woods, and thence far away to Morwen in Dorlomin in the house of his father, and he frowned because of the darkness of his thoughts, and made no answer to Cyrus. At this, believing the frown aimed at himself, Cyrus restrained his anger no longer, and he took out a golden comb and cast it on the board before Turin, crying, "Doubtless, man of Hithlum, you came in haste to this table, and may be excused your ragged cloak. But there is no need to leave your head untended as a thicket of brambles, and maybe if your ears were uncovered, you would heed better what is said to you." Turin said nothing, but turned his eyes upon Cyrus, and there was a glint in their darkness. But Cyrus did not heed the warning, and returned the gaze with scorn, saying for all to hear, "If the men of Hithlum are so wild and fell, of what sort are the women of that land? Do they run like the deer, clad only in their hair?" Then Turin took up a drinking vessel and cast it in Cyrus's face, and he fell backward with great hurt, and Turin drew his sword and would have run at him, but Mablung restrained him. Then Cyrus, rising, spat blood upon the board, and spoke as best he could with a broken mouth, "How long shall we harbour this wood woes? Who rules here to-night? The king's law is heavy upon those who hurt his lieges in the hall, and for those who draw blades there, outlawry is the least doom. Outside the hall I could answer you, wood woes." But when Turin saw the blood upon the table, his mood became cold, and with a shrug he released himself from Mablung, and left the hall without a word. Then Mablung said to Cyrus, "What ails you to-night? For this evil I hold you to blame, and maybe the king's law will judge a broken mouth a just return for your taunting. If the cub has a grievance, let him bring it to the king's judgment," answered Cyrus. "But the drawing of swords here is not to be excused for any such cause. Outside the hall, if the wood woes draws on me, I shall kill him." "It might well go otherwise," said Mablung, "but if either be slain, it will be an evil deed, more fit for Angband than Doriath, and more evil will come of it. Indeed, I feel that some shadow of the north has reached out to touch us to-night. Take heed, Cyrus, lest you do the will of Morgoth in your pride, and remember that you are of the Eldar." "I do not forget it," said Cyrus, but he did not abate his wrath, and through the night his malice grew, nursing his injury. In the morning he waylaid Turin as he set off early from Menegroth, intending to go back to the marches. Turin had gone only a little way when Cyrus ran out upon him from behind with drawn sword and shield on arm. But Turin, trained in the wild to wariness, saw him from the corner of his eye, and leaping aside, he drew swiftly and turned upon his foe. "Morwen," he cried, "now your mucker shall pay for his scorn," and he clove Cyrus's shield, and then they fought together with swift blades. But Turin had been long in a hard school, and had grown as agile as any elf, but stronger. He soon had the mastery, and wounding Cyrus's sword arm, he had him at his mercy. Then he set his foot on the sword that Cyrus had let fall. "Cyrus," he said, "there's a long race before you, and clothes will be a hindrance. Hair must suffice." And suddenly throwing him to the ground, he stripped him, and Cyrus felt Turin's great strength and was afraid. But Turin let him up, and then, "Run, run, mocker of women," he cried, "run, and unless you go swift as the deer, I shall prick you on from behind." Then he set the point of the sword in Cyrus's buttock, and he fled into the wood, crying wildly for help in his terror. But Turin came after him like a hound, and however he ran or swerved, still the sword was behind him to egg him on. The cries of Cyrus brought many others to the chase, and they followed after, but only the swiftest could keep up with the runners. Mablung was in the forefront of these, and he was troubled in mind, for though the taunting had seemed evil to him, malice that wakes in the morning is the mirth of Morgoth ere night. And it was held, moreover, a grievous thing to put any of the elven folk to shame, self-willed, without the matter being brought to judgment. None knew at that time that Turin had been assailed first by Cyrus, who would have slain him. "Hold, hold, Turin," he cried, "this is orc work in the woods. Orc work there was. This is only orc play," Turin called back. Before Mablung spoke, he had been on the point of releasing Cyrus, but now with a shout he sprang after him again, and Cyrus, despairing at last of aid and thinking his death close behind, ran wildly on until he came suddenly to a brink where a stream that fed Escalduin flowed in a deep cleft through high rocks, and it was wide for a deer leap. In his terror, Cyrus attempted the leap, but he failed of his footing on the far side, and fell back with a cry, and was broken on a great stone in the water. And so he ended his life in Doriath, and long would Mandos hold him. Turin looked down on his body lying in the stream, and he thought, "Unhappy fool! From here I would have let him walk back to Menegroth. Now he has laid a guilt upon me, undeserved." And he turned and looked darkly on Mablung and his companions, who now came up and stood near him on the brink. Then, after a silence, Mablung said gravely, "Alas, but come back now with us, Turin, for the king must judge these deeds." But Turin said, "If the king were just, he would judge me guiltless. But was not this one of his counsellors? Why should a just king choose a heart of malice for his friend?